All right, well, good morning. So I'd like to call to order this unofficial meeting of our work group on health and human services. I'm glad everybody could join us today. So we are getting together today to hear a presentation from DHS to kind of go through what they know at this point about how we can use federal funding that's available to us in our HHS budget. And so there are some good reasons, I think, for us to do this in this format. One is that I think that the public will also be interested, or at least some parts of the public might be interested to get the presentation along with us, just so that we all have sort of the same basic information. And I also think that anyone watching will probably draw from this how really complicated this all is. And I hope we'll understand what a huge task everybody has in putting together a budget this year. That's we all know that our budget is always complicated in health and human services, but this year it's particularly complicated. And so I hope people will have an appreciation of that at the end of this. I do want to mention that the slide deck has been sent out to members and to staff, and we will be posting that as well for members of the public. That should be, I think, on our website. So just to know that that's available, because I've looked through the slide deck pretty quickly, and boy, there's a lot of information there. So with that, unless members have anything they want to say, certainly Senator Benson, I don't know if I saw Senator Benson here. Oh, yes, certainly I do.
Absolutely.
Okay. So, Senator, if you want to say anything, go ahead. I see Senator Abler has his hand up. Senator Abler.
Question. Well, is there going to be a spreadsheet that'll be accompanying this as well, showing the pricing of FMAP and cash if we choose to do a particular item?
Well, Senator, I'm not aware that we have that for this presentation today. And okay. But, I think it'll be pretty hard for us to proceed without something like that. I don't know if...
All right, that's fine. I'm just asking.
Yeah, we could certainly.
That's fine. Thank you.
I mean, we're going to need a lot of, and we do need a lot of information and assistance to accomplish this task, because quite apart from anything that, any disagreements we might have between the House and Senate, we just all have the same big struggle to just figure out how the money can be used.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
And thank you, Senator. Anything else before we get started here? Okay, not seeing anything. So with that, I'm going to welcome DHS and thank you so much for putting this together. And is this going to be Ms. Bailey? Yeah, welcome. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Elise Bailey, Fiscal Policy Director for the department. And I'm going to start out the presentation today, and Dave Freeman will follow up on the second half of this presentation. So what we're planning to talk about today, as Chair Liebling mentioned, is the federal funds that are available to this committee as you kind of grapple with closing the budget here. There's some key pieces of information coming out of the federal law, ARPA, as it's called, that provided a significant amount of funding to the services that could be funded through your bill. One big piece is the Enhanced Home and Community-Based Services, FMAP, a federal match that the federal government has said that they would give states a 10% match on the home and community-based services that we provide, and that's the portion that I'm going to go over today with. I'll talk about what we know based on initial guidance received just about a week ago, hot off the press here, and then kind of link it to what provisions in your current bills we think align with that new funding. Mr. Greenman then will go through other funding available, and that includes the mental health block grants, substance use block grants, child care funding and pandemic emergency assistance funds.
And Ms. Bailey, just as we get going here, is there still a possibility that more guidance is coming in and some of this might change slightly? I mean, what's the over-under here as you present this to us?
Yeah, good question, Chair Liebling. I would say history would show that we usually get more information from CMS as time goes on, and sometimes that information does conflict with earlier guidance that they've put out. So at this presentation, I would perceive as a point in time on what we know now, and that it could shift a little bit as time goes on.
Thank you.
All right, we'll dive into it here. So as I said, the American Rescue Plan, specifically Section 9817, provided states with a temporary 10% point increase to the federal medical assistance percentage. So we call that the FMAP. I'll be calling it that throughout this presentation, for services they've defined as home and community-based services. And the FMAP will be collected by states for a period of 1 year from April 1st, 2021. So back to that date through March, oh, I think that's a typo, 31st, 2022. As part of this, states have to use the funds to supplement, not supplant, existing state funds expended for Medicaid HCBS or supporting the HCBS structure that we have in our state. We have to use the savings to implement or supplement the implementation of one or more activities, and those activities have to enhance, expand, or strengthen our HCBS under the Medicaid program. I'll go into detail on what that means here. So as far as claiming the 10%, our preliminary projections estimate that it's will exceed $560 million. So CMS had sent out, like I said, guidance about a week ago, and we didn't know up until that point how they would define home and community-based services. So we're frantically trying to estimate the final projections of what this 10% will be. And we know that it will exceed this $560 million. So we will supply members of this committee with that final estimate in probably, if not today, tomorrow, very shortly. The 10% is drawn down, like I said, for services paid between that 1 year time period listed. And in addition to that, that money that we get on the 10%, we can reinvest in the MAHCBS services during this first year and also claim a 10% match on those investments. So the services that they defined in the guidance include a large swath of services that frankly, we typically may not even define as home and community-based services in the typical conversation on HCBS. So the definition is pretty broad. It includes the waiver services that we have in our state, so the BI, CAT, CADI, DD, and EW waivers. It also includes Section 1115 waiver services, such as alternative care and our new substance use disorder 1115. It includes housing stabilization services, home health care, personal care services, all these provided under the state plan, private duty nursing provided in the home, case management services, and then a whole host of rehabilitative services. So under this group is a whole host of mental health services provided to adults, substance use disorder treatment services, things like physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech and hearing therapy, respiratory therapy services, and services defined as HCBS and the rest of this guidance that are delivered as part of an IEP in the school-based setting. So by claiming the enhanced FMAP, we have to agree to some things to CMS. We have to agree that we would use the equivalent amount of state funds to enhance, expand, or strengthen the Medicaid HCBS system. We have to do that by March 31st of 2024. And we have to tell them by June 13th of this year how we will do that. That plan will include a narrative from the state, kind of talking about all of the investments we plan to do and how they enhance, expand, or strengthen our Medicaid HCBS program. It would also include an estimate of how much we think the projections are and how much money would be attributed to each item under, you know, our plan. So the requirements are effective retroactively to April 1st, 2021, until the funds have already been spent, have been fully expended, whichever is soon, whichever is sooner between that and March 31st, 2024. So, and these are the, there's some program requirements that we have to comply with in order to get this funding. The federal funds attributable to the increased FMAP have to be used to supplement the existing funds or the existing funds that we have expended in effect as of April 1st, 2021. And we have to use an equivalent amount of funds attributable to the increased FMAP to implement or supplement the implementation of one or more activities to expand, enhance, or strengthen HCBS beyond what is available as of April 1st, 2021. So to demonstrate compliance, with the requirement, there are some requirements in the guidance that state that we cannot impose stricter eligibility standards, methodologies, or procedures to the HCBS programs or services as of April 1st, 2021. We have to preserve the services covered under the HCBS. So this includes the services themselves, the amount that we spend, the duration and scope of the services. And we have to maintain provider payments at a rate no less than that what was in place on April 1st, 2021. So shifting into, you know, we qualify for the HCBS, shifting into how we can reinvest the money. As I've said many times in this presentation, it has to enhance, expand, or strengthen Medicaid HCBS. So very particular to the Medicaid HCBS program. Although we do think the guidance states that we can invest to services that are not limited to what's typically covered under Medicaid. The investments just have to have a link to or connect to enhancing, expanding, or strengthening our Medicaid program. The guidance also establishes expectations that any increases in payments to providers should be passed through to the direct care workers in the form of some sort of compensation increases. And we have to submit a description about how we plan to sustain the investments that we have made beyond the what they call the improvement period. So beyond the March 31st, 2024 date, how do we plan to sustain what we've invested? So this this chart is basically ideas that the federal government put out in their guidance on allowable activities that states could choose to implement to use these funds. And I'd move to the next slide, so I'll go over some things, shift over to what's in the current bills that you have before you and what is in current law considered eligible. So because the guidance states that the marker is April 1st, 2021, we have some state investments that you've already approved through the legislature that are not yet implemented on 4-1 that would enhance, expand, or strengthen the system and therefore would be considered eligible. So these changes would amount to about $76 million in 22-23 and $107.5 in 24-25. And the items we've identified include the inflationary rate adjustments for the Disability Waiver Rate System, or DWRS. Those under current law are set to be implemented on July 1st, 2022, and we could claim the cost of that through the March 31st, 2024 date. Also included in the forecast and under current law are budget cap increases in the Elderly Waiver and Alternative Care programs. Those occur annually as nursing facility rates increase over time. The budget caps for those programs increase over time. And then the community first services and supports change, we have projected that implementation to occur in the fall of 2021. And with that implementation, there's several enhancements that we're making to that program that we also believe would be considered eligible. So there's many proposals in both of your bills that would be considered eligible uses of these funds. Of course, we would only be able to count them in the period to which the implementation period exists. So between April of this year and March of 2024. But this is a kind of a list of those proposals that you could consider as part of the HCBS FMAP. So there's several provisions that have rate reform or rate increases for medical assistance services defined as HCBS in this guidance. And some examples include, of course, the personal care assistance rate increases, the framework, as well as many rate increases you have in the bill for things such as home health services, elderly waiver services, the substance use rate increases under the 1115 demo, and many. And as Senator Abler asked earlier in this presentation, we can provide the committee with a detailed list of what these are. There's also many items in your bills that expand the services or eligibility for services. So examples are the eligibility for the PCA enhanced rate, changing that from 10 hours or 12 hours to 10 hours, enabling more people to access that. Expanding telehealth services. So your bills, include a wide array of services that would be included under telehealth, but we think about half of the cost of those bills would be services covered under the guidance or under the definition of HCBS that you could include with this. Expanding access to MA-funded SUD services. So your proposal on the 1115 demo mandate, we think that the costs attributed to those packages would be included under eligible uses. Elimination of TEFRA fees, that could be seen as, expanding access to HCBS services for people and could be included as a cost for this service, for HCBS. And then there's several reform initiatives. So case management redesign, waiver reimagine, mental health uniform services and standards. These are mostly administrative costs that you would be including, but they would be seen as ways that the state could invest to expand, enhance, or strengthen the system as a whole. There's also studying or planning for future reforms that you have in your bill, such as PCA, planning for providing PCA in acute care hospitals, planning for a PACE program, studying equity in the HCBS program. Those are things that we think could be included as eligible expenses. And so all of those were really connected to the MA program. They either added cost to the MA services themselves, or they were administrative costs related to expanding the MA program. The items on this list are state-funded grant initiatives that we think also would apply because they have a direct connection to expanding, enhancing, or strengthening the HCBS services in Medicaid. So some examples include your grants on promoting self-advocacy for people with disabilities or inclusion, providing grants to childcare providers to promote inclusion of kids with disabilities. We think those could be eligible uses. Housing in that the community living infrastructure grants, those would help connect people receiving HCBS to housing. Sober home oversight study, we think that could be included. Culturally informed and culturally responsive mental health task force and the customized living quality improvement. These are all examples of state-funded grants that we think could work to really enhance, expand, or strengthen, the infrastructure around the HCBS in Medicaid. I'd like to highlight a few items that we, as we looked at every single item on the docket, we determined were not eligible uses. So changes to MA services that are not included in the definition of HCBS, we're assuming that all of those services that they define that we can get the FMAP on, those are also the services that we can invest the money on. Not included in that definition are things like non-emergency medical transportation or children's crisis services. Those are items that we don't think we could include in the spending plan. Also, non-MA investments that don't have an impact or connection to the Medicaid HCBS defined in the guidance. Those could include housing, so housing support, and homelessness investments that don't really have a direct connection to enhancing or strengthening HCBS. And then, of course, any other item on the list that doesn't expand, enhance, or strengthen the HCBS services. There's also items on the list that we believe the guidance now does not allow us to do if we want to claim the enhanced FMAP 10%. And so this is a small list of items, rate reform resulting in reduced payment rates. So under this category, the family foster care rate reform or the remote provision of services rate reform, those are items that would reduce provider payments during this implementation period. We could not implement that between the dates of April 1st, 2021 and March 31st, 2024. Also on this list are things like limiting waiver caseload growth or limiting the spending that we do on assessments. I'd like to point out also that not all savings proposals related to HCBS would be considered not allowable. So we have a few, for instance, BRC proposals where we're aligning billing rules with program integrity, for instance, for customized living. We believe that that would be an allowable proposal even with these requirements. So lastly, as I kind of wrap up here on the enhanced FMAP, I'd like to just comment on what a profound opportunity we have with this, these funds to really enhance our system and the experience of people receiving services through HCBS. So we have a challenge at hand, but it's a good challenge to have. Some considerations as this committee thinks about how you want to invest this money. You know, we have a limited time period, obviously, to decide how to identify the investment. So as I said, we have to submit a plan to CMS by June 13th. And then we have to submit quarterly reports over the improvement period to tell them how we are spending the money and give updates. Also, the limited time period that the funds are available. So these aren't ongoing funds that we'll receive from the federal government. So we'll have to kind of grapple with ongoing versus one-time investments. And one question we have out there is really how much does CMS care about whether we have an ongoing investment in every area that we identify? And then, of course, supporting the direct care workforce. In the guidance, they made clear that they expect rate increases to be passed on to the folks doing the work. And we do have a workforce shortage, one would say. So this is kind of one area we might want to consider how we can really get the funds to folks doing the hard work supporting people with disabilities and people receiving HCBS. And then lastly, I couldn't get out of this presentation from DHS without saying that the operational challenges of implementing these things need to be at front of mind, whether, you know, how much time would it take to implement something, whether we would need federal approval to do so, do we need systems changes to do so. So those are some considerations that we'll have to keep front of mind. Although we're submitting the spending plan within 30 days, we also have to submit any changes to rates, we have to go through the regular federal process for changes to our Medicaid program. So there will be a lot of work that has to be done to get any changes approved by the federal government. From here, I'll open it up for questions.
All right. Well, thank you, Ms. Bailey. And I, and Senator Benson has her hand up. And I just wanted to comment too that, just because the public is watching too here, to say that Ms. Bailey, one of the things that you didn't say explicitly, but is really strongly implicit in what you said, is that after this March 20 of 2024 date, we will face cliffs in that the money will go away. So this committee knows, this work group knows that that's something we have to be attentive to. So I just wanted to point that out for anybody who may be watching, who might not really be aware of that dynamic, that that's something we really have to keep our eyes on. So Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Bailey, for your presentation. And Madam Chair, you raised the deep tails impact, so tails and deep tails. I agree, we need to keep our eyes on it. And I know Mr. Greenman is joining us as well, but I'm hoping that he, Mr. Albrecht, Mr. Berg, can help us get some sense of deep tails, even though it's not a requirement, so that we know what we're setting ourselves up for. And then the second thing, and this is to Ms. Bailey, is there any percentage limit on admin costs? Do we get to do any sort of federal drawdown for systems that would be in addition to this? Because sometimes there's a systems match, but I don't know if that applies for one-time changes. So if you could help me understand percent admin costs that are allowable, if there are any restrictions, and then systems costs.
Ms. Bailey?
Sure, Chair Liebling, Senator Benson. That's a good question. There is nothing in the guidance, and that's really what we're going off right now. We've had a few calls with CMS, but nothing that really expanded our knowledge beyond this guidance. So there's nothing in the guidance that limits the amount of administrative costs that could be funded through the 10% match. To your second question related to that, we would draw down the typical FFP that we would in any change to the Medicaid program. So we would, you know, if we were adding FTEs, we would draw down the 32% match. If we were doing a systems change, we would draw down that applicable systems percentage. We do know that those items, though, we can't then and go get the 10% match on. So if we were to implement it now before the period's over, we can't get more 10% off those costs.
Senator Benson?
Madam Chair, I just had trouble getting unmuted. That answers my questions for this portion. I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. So I have Senator Abler and then Representative Pinto. Senator Abler.
Thanks, and you won't be surprised. I have lots of questions, but I'll just stick with the most high-level ones. June 13th, we have to, or something, we have to come up with a plan. I'm curious how many of those things that we want to do require legislative approval, and I would guess a whole bunch of them. So it's lucky we're all getting along and eager to get this resolved. It's actually maybe a perfect schedule, but it's, I don't know, can you just comment about what you're, I mean, we have, clearly the Senate has spent some money and the House didn't, but they would have plenty of ideas as well. And maybe the Elise can just comment about how, you know, and the governor didn't know what they could do. And I love the list of things that are possibilities. It's, I think the Senate reflects a lot of that. So can you just comment about what you think that would look like as we go through our process here?
Ms. Bailey?
Ms. Bailey, I think, yeah.
Yeah. Sure, Senator Abler, I think that's a great question. The timeline is, to be honest, quite tight for the department to kind of turn around. You get agreement this week or next week, and we're turning it around by June 13th. It is quite tight. We will do what we can to hit that, though. I mean, we're in close contact, we meaning, you know, the legislative staff, with our federal relations to kind of be up to date as we are and kind of gearing for submission on that plan. So I think it's tight. We would like more time, but it is what it is. So.
And so, Madam Chair, just one more question. And so I might have been distracted, but let's say we buy a rate or something that during that initial period where we, you know, spend something that would have been compensated, do we get a bonus match on that as well? Is that also subject to the additional 10%? Let's say we raise home care rates by, I don't know, the people want like 5%. Yeah, everybody's cheering in the audience. Let's say do a 5% home care rate increase effective July 1st or whatever. Does that earn additional match for those 9 months?
Ms. Bailey?
Senator Abler, to the extent that it is implemented before March 31st, 2022, we would get a 10% match for all those services provided during that time. I would say that we also, you know, we have systems and federal approval timelines to kind of implement those things, so it might be challenging to do it quite quickly. But to the extent that we're able to, we would draw down a 10% match in that initial time period.
Thank you. We'll have to hurry. We'll put in there, you have to do it really, really quick. How's that? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Senator. And, you know, Ms. Bailey, on that note, just to be really clear about this for people watching and for members too, when we talk about 10% additional match, normally, as we know, for many things, Minnesota gets a 50-50 match. So the federal government is paying for half of our Medicaid costs or medical assistance, as we call it here. And then under pandemic, we've been getting more than that. And now, so are we talking about 10% on top of the, you know, 10% of what? Maybe you could just, I could ask it that way, just to be really clear.
Sure, Chair Liebling. You know, the average match we get is about 50%. It does vary by population. Some up to 90%, some, you know, lower. So yeah, the average for this area of service is about 50%. As you mentioned, we also have the 6.5%, I believe, for the pandemic enhanced match. And so this 10% would be on top of that. With one caveat, for the group of people that we already get a 90% match on, and then we have the 6 on top of that, we the guidance says we can't exceed a 95% match. So there is some complexity in some of the services and populations served here.
Okay, thank you. Always more complexity in our space. That is always true. Okay, have Representative Pinto and then Senator Hoffman. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So speaking of complexity, I was intrigued by the comment along the way about the inclusive childcare potentially being something that could be funded through the HCBS money. And if you could just talk about that, maybe just first clarify that a little bit. You may be aware that there's a provision of both the House and the Senate bill, Article 16 of the House and Article 19 of the Senate, for grants for childcare for children with disabilities. And so just if Ms. Bailey, you could expand on that a little bit.
Ms. Bailey?
Yes, Representative Pinto. You know, as we looked through each item on the list, you know, we're thinking about, A, is this a change to the Medicaid program? And obviously that isn't one. But B, if it's not, does it have the capacity to enhance, strengthen, or enhance or strengthen the HCBS services provided to folks? We believe that that proposal has the potential to strengthen or expand children's access in an inclusive environment to HCBS services. And so we felt like that was a nice fit for the uses of these funds.
And just a quick follow-up. Thank you. Just a quick follow-up on that. And then, and apologies for kind of betraying my ignorance here, but so it sounds like an advantage then of that, of funding it this way, would be then the 10% bump, but we sort of get, you know, a portion of it paid for by the federal government as opposed, or I guess it's regardless, but we get an additional bonus in a way and get that much more to be able to spend on it. Am I understanding that correctly? Is the advantage of doing this through HCBS as opposed to through, you know, another federal funding source?
Ms. Bailey?
Representative Pinto, I don't think we would get another 10% on top of the funds that we would spend here.
Okay.
That is only when we're adding to the actual MA program and we're drawing down a match on those programs. So this would kind of be out of that space. Let's say the benefit would be able to track it through your target on HCBS enhanced match versus something else.
Okay. Madam Chair, thank you. And Ms. Bailey, thank you. That's helpful. So it sounds like if that would be funded through another federal source, then there may be an issue of sort of how much federal money is remaining in any of these buckets. But it's not like there's some sort of bonus or discount or something that we get by doing it this way as opposed to another. I see you nodding. So, okay, good. That's helpful clarification. Thanks very much.
Right. Nice try, Representative Pinto.
I was trying.
It's always, we got to always try to push it. Absolutely. Senator Hoffman.
You got to give David points on that. Absolutely. You know, if you can't try to push for something, right, why are we even, right, doing it? So how do I lower my hand? There it is. Thank you, Madam Chair. I like your background, by the way. I drive that monthly. So, Ali, Ms. Bailey, thank you. As I was listening to you, I was looking at the letter that was sent out. Most of your information came from that letter that went to the Medicaid state directors, right? So a couple of interesting points, and I know we didn't bring this up earlier because we ran out of time, but I was really happy to see that they included the PACE program in there as far as expanding services or expanding or enhancing. So there's good conversation in there. And it would be my understanding, based upon reading that letter and looking at a potential provision, that would all be allowable with how that it could be allowable with how that current structure is set up. Do you agree with that?
Ms. Bailey?
Senator Hoffman, yes, we agree that the provision in the Senate that provides funding to plan for the PACE program would be an eligible use of the funds.
Good. I'm glad to hear that, because you just validated my thought on that. And I was also happy to see what the work we had done, you know, last year on the retainer payment side of it, that they actually extended, you know, three more offset of 30 days of expansion under the retainer side as well. So this has been very helpful to me, Ms. Bailey, and also noting that the elimination of TEFR fees could absolutely be included in this conversation as well. So thank you for putting this together, and thank you, Madam Chair.
And Ms. Bailey, on that retainer payment piece, was there some additional complexity to that? I sort of seem to remember that what that, just like HCBS has a particular definition now, do the retainer payments, is it, you know, can you clarify, if we did again what we had done before, would that be eligible?
Chair Liebling, right, that they define in Medicaid land, they define retainer payment as a payment that's given when a person can't technically receive the service. And so if we were to design a proposal that added more retainer payments, we would have to be paying for people not being at the service and not being able to receive the service. And so it's kind of a more defined proposal that would have to really only pull out people who would have received the service absent something like the pandemic and aren't receiving it, versus something else that they call a supplemental payment to providers. That would be a different mechanism.
And of course, that's kind of what we did before, but it might not have been linked, or we might need to make a closer link, I'm understanding. But Senator Hoffman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, to that point, and then I have another follow-up question, but to that point, it's that, you know, may assist states in providing for either reopening those services while limiting access to, I mean, there is all these what-if clauses in there too. So I'm just happy to see that in there. And then I guess I have a follow-up question is, do you know the reasoning behind, Ms. Bailey, do you know the reasoning behind while children's mental health crisis services would not be eligible? Is there something that bubbles that, please?
Ms. Bailey?
Senator Hoffman, yeah, that is a question we actually have been writing out to CMS right now. What we found is that the mental health services provided to adults occur under our rehabilitative section of Medicaid, and that the crisis mental health services provided to children fall in a different area. So we do have a question out on whether that was an intentional that they didn't want to include children's mental health crisis services, or is it just simply a miss? So we have that same question.
So thank you. And Madam Chair, as a follow-up, thank you. Do you know, Ms. Bailey, expectation of when the Centers for Medicaid Services might get that TA request back to you?
Ms. Bailey? Can
you give us time?
Yeah, Senator Huffman, we don't know. So we assume they're getting lots of questions from lots of states, and that they're also cognizant of the fact that we have to give them something very quickly. So hopefully soon, but we don't know when we'll get any response.
Okay, and Ms. Bailey, if we don't hit that deadline, I know we'll hit it with something, we'll be giving them something, but is there a penalty attached to that if we were a week late? You know, what will happen? Is that how big of a deal is that? Do you know?
Cheerleading, we don't know if what would happen if we would miss that deadline. They did have, a Q&A session with states, and states asked, well, will we be tied to what we give you, And they did indicate some sort of leeway on modifying a plan or having more detail at a later date. So we're hopeful that they'll come up with, updated guidance based on probably all the feedback they've gotten from states since last week. But yeah, at this point, it's unclear.
Okay, great. Well, yeah. And again, how much complexity we're dealing with here. It's really quite amazing. And thank you very much. And so we only went through part of the presentation, and I think was it Mr. Greenman or somebody else was going to continue now with another piece of it to talk about other funding? Because this is not it. That is not all. So,
Mr. Greenman. Madam Chair, Dave Greenman with the Department of Human Services. I was going to talk a little bit about a portion of the slideshow that I'm going to talk about has to do with the block grants that the state has gotten as a result of the both the Consolidated Appropriations Act and the American Rescue Plan, that the legislature has put a hold on these funds and is looking at spending them in the budget bill. So this is just some information about those funds, what they are, what we can spend them on, what plans the department has if there isn't legislation to spend these dollars. So I'm just going to walk through those briefly for people.
Okay. And Mr. Greenman, that does raise a question, just a foundational question before you get going on that. So the funds you're going to discuss now can be spent without legislative approval if it comes to that, I'm understanding you to say. But what about the funds we just discussed? Is that under a different kind of, if the legislature does not spend those funds, what happens to them?
The home and community-based services dollars you're talking
yes.
about? Well, I don't think we have a solid understanding of what kind of penalties the state would face if we were to claim the enhanced FMAP and not spend that savings on enhancements to home and community-based services within the time period allowed, which is, as Ms. Bailey said, the end of March of 2024. It's not clear what the penalty would be for that. That's why we need to have a plan in place for making sure we do spend those dollars.
Okay, but my question is, then that's good to know, but my question is really more to who gets to decide on them.
Okay.
So if the legislature can't come up with a plan for all of those dollars in our regular budget process, can the administration allocate the rest of the money?
I think it would be very difficult for the administration to do it just because so much of what we do is in statute. In terms of setting rates, expanding services, providing, we really just don't have the authority to do that without the legislature.
Okay, that's what I wanted to clarify. Okay, thank you. Please, sure. Please go ahead.
Okay. So the first set of grants, these are the mental health block grants. These are grants that the state gets through SAMHSA, which is the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Act. These are dollars the state normally gets. We get an annual allotment of the mental health block grants. These are two special allotments that we've gotten as a result of the two bills that passed, the two federal bills I mentioned earlier. Mental health block grants are mainly for community-based mental health prevention and treatment for young people and adults. And so with the Consolidated Appropriations Act, we got about $12.5 million. And under the American Rescue Plan, we got about $21.6 million. There are set-asides for these funds. So there's we automatically have to spend a certain amount of these funds on specific activities. Like 5% has to go to crisis services. 10% needs to go to the first episode psychosis program or services. And then 25% needs to go to North Indian Mental Health Services. The first two are federally required. The last one is a state law that requires those funds to be distributed for that purpose. So after the set asides, there's about $7.5 million available through the Consolidated Appropriations Act, and then about $12.9 million or $13 million available through ARPA. There are also different dates by which these funds have to be spent. The Consolidated Appropriations Act amount needs to be spent by 3/14 of 23, and the American Rescue Act plan or American Rescue Plan Act funds have to be spent by September 30th of 25. So what can the funds be used for? As I said, the eligible uses for the under the Consolidated Appropriations Act include adults and children, evidence-based services, where there's peer-reviewed research and outcomes-based evidence that the services work. We can use it for phone lines, for crisis phones, hotlines, things like that. We can use it for training, both mental health staff and also like educators and the police departments. We can use it for peer support, for hiring staff to do peer support work. We can use it for prison reentry, and we can use it to respond to specific requirements or specific needs that come out of the COVID crisis. There are some restrictions on how these funds can be spent. It cannot be spent for inpatient services. It can't be used for construction or rehabbing facilities or businesses or buildings. It can't be used to provide the non-federal share for example, medical assistance. The funds cannot go to for-profit organizations, and it can't be used for cash payments to individuals. We are required to submit a plan, which we did submit on April 3rd of 2021 for how we would spend the funds absent legislation. And as you can see that we spend it on a variety of activities, including some that are the set-asides, like the crisis services, $2.3 million, $1.3 million for first episode psychosis, and $3.4 million for the American Indian Tribal Services. The other things we spend the money on that are outside the set-asides include $1.7 million for cultural, ethnic, and services infrastructure to fill gaps in services. $1.2 million is for workforce, and $1.5 million is to fill gaps in terms of equitable access to services. And then $450,000 is for administration. The funds for the American Rescue Plan, under the American Rescue Plan, have the same eligible uses. There is some ability or flexibility on these particular funds to waive certain requirements in order to facilitate our response to COVID. These funds also have the same restrictions as those under the Consolidated Appropriations Act. And then these are due. We do have a plan that's due on July 2nd. Right now, what we're thinking about in terms of that plan is about $1.1 million for crisis services, $2.2 million for first episode psychosis, $5.4 million for the American Indian Services, and then $1 million for school-linked mental health, and then 10.3 million for prevention, education, recovery, and 1.1 million for administration. So the next type of grants we're going to talk about are substance abuse block grants. These are dollars that the state gets also through SAMHSA. We also get a regular allocation annually, and these are special amounts or allocations that we got as a result in response to COVID. And so we got about $22.6 million under the Consolidated Appropriations Act and about $19.5 million under the American Rescue Plan. There are set-asides for this. There's a 20% set-aside for prevention and an actual dollar amount for services that, or amount that has to be set aside for pregnant women and children, about $4.4 million. And this comes from the MOE on these, that was the maintenance of effort requirement that was originally in place on these grants. I believe it was back in 1994. The amount available after set-asides is about, you can see that what's available after set-asides. The expiration on these funds is March 14th of 2023 under the Consolidated Appropriations Act and September 30th of 2025 under the American Rescue Plan. But what these funds can be used for the substance abuse block grant, under the Consolidated Appropriations Act, these dollars can be used for pregnant women to treat and prevent substance abuse for pregnant women and mothers, treatment and services for the uninsured, evidence-based services, and performance and outcome data to measure the success or effectiveness of the services and programs. Restrictions include the same as those for the mental health block grant. Funds can't be used for inpatient services, can't be used for construction, buildings, or facilities. It can't be used for the non-federal share of costs. It can't go to for-profit entities, and it cannot go to as cash payments to individuals. We were required to submit a plan for these dollars, absent legislative activity, and that plan includes $4.8 million for primary prevention, $4.5 million for pregnant services for pregnant women, $12 million for intervention, treatment, and recovery, and $970,000 for administration.
And Mr. Greenman, let me pause you right there, if it's okay, because Representative Gomez has her hand up. And Representative Gomez?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Liebling. I actually had a question on a slide that was a couple back that it was maybe three back that had under this one. I guess I'm just wondering to what extent you've explored the allowed use under the Consolidated Appropriations Act under prison reentry. In my division this year, we heard from the Department of Corrections about, I mean, it's sort of like the rates are almost unbelievable of like how many people who are coming out of prison experience episodes of homelessness. It was like 30%, 50%, like in this area. And so I know that we did do a small kind of planning appropriation in the public safety bill to the Department of Corrections to do some planning kind of around how to support folks who are coming out of incarceration, who are at kind of this really high risk of experiencing homelessness. So I just wondered if you guys had explored that at all, or like, I guess just broadly, I would say that, the targets that were agreed upon in housing were really disappointing. Our targets, we have as much money for the Minnesota Zoo as we do for housing in a year. And so I guess I'm sort of trying, as we're going through this federal funding, to look at the places where we can make investments in housing and preventing homelessness through other areas, because our general fund target was really just so inadequate in that area. So I don't know if anybody has any thoughts on that.
Mr. Greenman, is that something you can address, or you know, and or if your folks need a minute or two to think about it too, we could finish the rest and then return to that point if you prefer.
Sure. Or maybe at this point, it might just be more of a comment at this point. I don't know if there it needs a reaction, but I am interested maybe down the line in kind of learning more about whether you kind of connected with DPS on this or
DOC. Yeah, no, it's a great question, Representative Gomez. I also was interested to see that on the list here and wondered kind of what that meant. Because, I mean, we are talking about a mental health block grant and, you know, so I'd like to hear a bit more about that too, but it's a more specific, I just wonder, I don't know if Mr. Greenman's kind of prepared to answer it right this second, that's all. Mr. Greenman, up to you.
Madam Chair, Representative Gomez, that is a really good question. I believe we may have been looking at some prison reentry work around equity gaps or workforce issues, but I want to defer and talk to my much more knowledgeable people in our mental health program area to get a little more information, but we can certainly get that for you and follow up with you on that. That would be helpful.
Representative Gomez?
No, that's good. Thank you. Look forward to more conversation about it.
All right. Thank you. Representative Schultz?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And related to that comment, I'm interested to know, could we use any of these block grants from mental health or substance abuse to help enroll those who are coming out of prison or jail into public health insurance programs or even private health insurance programs? Is that an allowable use? And, you know, you can send me that answer later if you don't have it now.
Okay. We'd have to probably look into that to get a more specific answer to that question.
Okay. All right. Mr. Greenman, go ahead if you can pick up where you left off here. Thanks for taking those questions.
Sure. So I think I was going to talk about the funds available under the Substance Abuse Block Grant under the American Rescue Plan. These are available for largely the same purposes, eligible uses as the Consolidated Appropriations Act. They're with the exception of like the mental health grants under the ARPA bill, there is some ability to waive, SAMHSA has ability to waive some requirements to facilitate the response to COVID. These have the same restrictions as those above. And let's see. And then the due date is July 2nd of 2021 to get a plan into for how to spend these dollars if there's no legislative action. And our plan would be about $3.9 million for the SUD primary prevention services, $4.5 million for pregnant women, $10.3 million for treatment and treatment awareness and education for culturally specific services, and $976,000 for administration. And I'm told by somebody in our staff that in response to Representative Gomez's question that our housing division does have a program that works with the Department of Corrections to connect people to benefits upon discharge. So I guess it's response to both Representative Gomez and Representative Schultz's question, but we'll certainly get more information and follow up on those questions. Okay, I think we can go to the next slide. The next set of information we have is about some of the child care funds that the department has received in both, particularly in the American Rescue Plan Act. These were dollars that the legislature is proposing to spend in the omnibus finance bills, and wanted to just share some information with you about those. The first one is a supplementary discretionary child care development block grant funding. This is the main source of funding the state gets from the federal government to pay for our child care assistance programs. This is known as the CCDBG money. The state gets an allotment every year, but this is special money that's coming through as a result of the pandemic. The allowable uses for these funds are very broad, including supporting access for low-income families, improving quality, and supporting the child care industry. We also received some mandatory child care development funds, which is an increase in federal funding that's very similar to the CCDBG block grants and can be used for essentially the same purpose. The nice thing about these dollars is that it's a permanent ongoing annual increase. And so it's not a one-time fund. It's actually an increase on an ongoing basis. And the third source of funding is for the child care staff stabilization grant funding. And these are, dollars that are meant, about $324 million that are meant to address the financial burden of, on the child care industry of the COVID, of the pandemic. And these are meant to provide stabilization grants to childcare providers, whether open or closed, and 90% of these dollars need to go directly, at least 90% need to go directly to providers. There are deadlines for using these dollars. The CCDBG dollars, the supplementary funds, need to be obligated by September 30th of 23 and liquidated by September 30th of 24. The mandatory dollars are allocated each year, and we need to obligate them by September 30th of the following year and spend them the year after that. In terms of childcare stabilization grant funding, these dollars need to be obligated by September 30th of 22 and liquidated by September 30th of 23.
Senator Hoffman has his hand up. Senator Hoffman?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Greenman. One of the things that popped is that $4.5 million pregnancy and women's services that you had highlighted in there. I guess the question, it might be a policy question to you. You know that under the Department of Health, which is really odd how I saw, one of the 11 indicators the state of Minnesota says under the Maternal Child Health Bureau, specifically the Title V, public health, you're shaking your head. One of the 11 indicators, there are three out of those 11 specifically pertaining to pregnancy. Number one is the care during pregnancy and delivery, the comprehensive early childhood system, and then the third one is the infant mortality, right? That's always one that's been an indicator. Was there any conversation about them saying to the department, you must do this in conjunction with your obligation under Title V, that comprehensive system, or did they just say here, DHS, do this? What are your thoughts on that?
Mr. Greenman, anything?
Madam Chair, Senator Hoffman, I think that's a really good question. I think it would make sense for us to be working with our Title V program on this. I don't have a specific answer. I'd need to go back to our child care folks, our mental health or substance abuse block grant folks, and find out a little more information about that. But I'll certainly do that and follow up with you.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up, but there's also, you know, there's a whole thing too on there on the substance abuse too within Title V. So it just, I just found it really odd that they would send that kind of thing over to DHS without any instructions. But I know the overall umbrella is that the state must have an integrated system. So thank you for that information, Mr. Greenman. Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you. And Mr. Greenman, I think, I'd be interested in that as well. So maybe should be shared more broadly. And I know Mr. Greenman knows almost everything, but I just, you know, don't want to always assume he knows absolutely everything. So anyway, please go ahead.
Okay. So, and again, like with the mental health and the substance abuse block grants, in the absence of legislation, thought we would develop a plan for spending these funds. And I think our plan is in some ways similar to some of the approaches that the House and Senate have taken, not the same. Definitely there's some major differences, but there's some similarities as well. For the mandatory and the discretionary CCDBG dollars, this includes the $202 million CCDBG funds and then the $9.2 million ongoing mandatory funds. We're assuming to spend the dollars the following way. About $172 million would support low-income families in accessing childcare through the CCAP maximum rates and also increasing access to the basic sliding fee childcare program. This would be through reprioritization of the basic sliding fee program. that we'd be doing on an ongoing basis. Also includes $14.8 million to support the childcare industries because it's such an important sector of our economy and in our response to the COVID crisis. And the third sort of pool of funds we would use this for would be $15.5 million to address equity and make some systematic and long-term improvements to the childcare sector through some piloting, evaluation, and infrastructure improvements. And the next source of funds is the stabilization dollars. What we would propose to do is to use about $306 million for the childcare stabilization grants for providers that's required under federal law. We would use about $17.6 million to support the new childcare industry, or to support the childcare industry as an essential sector. Again, this would be the same as we would use it for the other grant, or the other allocation to support increasing the availability of and supply of childcare and workforce issues as well in the state. So the last source of funds I was going to talk about are the pandemic emergency assistance funds. And these are dollars that the state got through the ARPA bill. This is about $14.4 million in our allocation. These funds have to be spent by September 30th of 2022. They can be used, the federal law explicitly allows them to be used for non-recurrent short-term benefits in the form of cash or other forms of assistance. No more than 15% can be spent for administrative purposes, and funds cannot have to supplement what's currently being spent and not supplant other federal, state, or tribal funds to support the purposes of the funds. And the next slide. Oh, thanks. So the purpose of these funds closely mirrors one of the governor's budget priorities, which is the $750 relief payments to families under the MFIP program. This would be the one-time cash grant. So the department's plan, absent legislation on this, would be to use it to supplement that funding for the grants. This would be consistent with the congressional intent, would benefit about 64,000 children and their families. And it would help those households that turn to MFIP as a result of their exposure to COVID and complications of COVID. So that's where we're at with our federal funds and our block grants right now. I'm happy to answer any additional questions people have.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Mr. Greenman. That's a lot of information. Senator Abler.
Sorry, I had to unmute. Well, this is really helpful. It's nice to get more and more guidance. And it seems as though the administration and, you know, if the Senate represents the legislature, I think we're kind of going a lot of the same direction. I know I'm talking to Representative Pinto, some of the same ideas. So that's encouraging. I do have a question on the $306 million revitalization thing. In the Senate, we were talking about trying to help some of the desert situation where some of the facilities are run down, they have bad heat costs and so on, which really add to their operations. And we put some money into some improvements there. I know it has to be grants to providers. Is there, they have to be tied to a specific purpose? And so I think we spent $70 million on such in our budget. So, and I have one more question after that, Madam Chair. So.
Sure, Mr. Greenman.
Madam Chair, Senator Abler, I think the administration has the same interest in addressing the facility issue or the facility shortage. I think it's taken somewhat of a different approach. For example, the governor's bonding bill has the bonding bill has a couple of provisions in it that deal with childcare assistance. I can't remember if it was in the governor's budget or not, but it has been in the past in the governor's budget for bonding. And I think there's some in the House bill as well for facilities. But that's I think that's kind of the approach that the administration has taken in the past on this. And I know that there's also some specific funds that we got under the ARPA bill that go for, that can be used for capital improvements. And I'm not sure what the process is for using those funds and what the ideas are for those dollars.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Abler.
And Mr. Greenman, I have always appreciated your optimism. The governor's budget bill is, I mean, it's a lovely bill and may it well become law, but there's some things that are, I don't know, that are hopeful about that. But just in terms of the money we have in front of us that we truly do get to spend, is part of that money, can we, if in a grant to providers, could we earmark some of those funds to be used either by application or by just giving some to everybody to fix up their places? Is that something we can do?
My understanding is that the funds can be used for some level of rehab, but that it's certainly not new construction and it's not major rehab, but it could be used for some level of renovation. And I think, and I could be told I'm wrong, but I believe there's a federal definition that I don't have at the tips of my fingers. Right. About what that level of renovation is, but I believe that's my understanding.
All right, thanks, and Madam Chair.
Sure, Senator Abler.
So thanks. I really appreciate that, and I'm really happy to see the interest. I think from all three groups. I know the House had a smaller number, but I think it's a really key need. And so, if at the end of all this money washing through, the places could be a little better equipped to weather the long-term, operational thing, that would be, I think, desirable. So I'll be looking into that. Madam Chair, one other question.
Sure, Senator Abler.
I think on those grants, there was $5 million on what amounts to public health grants and some other, I thought, rather curious numbers for administration. I know when the Senate, I don't know the details how the governor was going to spend that for those grants to providers, but we used the existing framework. And then just tapered the money down. So I don't know how there'd be almost any new administration for that. So Mr. Greenman, could you comment about what you would buy with $5 million of administration?
Mr. Greenman.
Madam Chair, Senator Abler, I don't have that information with me right now. I know that there is, there's a number of things related to communications, to providers, to mailings, to outreach. Expenditures along those lines. I don't have the information with me right now, but we can certainly get that for you. One thing I would point out is that's about 1.6% overhead. So that's pretty low on the terms of overhead, but I get your point about it being something that's the department's done before. This is a different, this is actually, there are specific rules about the stabilization grant program that are different than what's in the public health grants that we currently give. So we do have to develop a new program to do things differently. There's just different eligibility rules about who gets the funds and some other rules around how we can distribute the funds. So,
Senator Abler, and then I'll go to Representative Pinto.
I just a comment. And so, I mean, Madam Chair, you and I and the whole committee and this whole, everybody watching this is used to large numbers. Oh, it's just a percent and a half. Pretty soon a percent and a half is a pretty big number. And the leaner these admin numbers can be, Madam Chair, I'm sure you would agree, the more we can trust the other admin numbers they give us. So I'll stop. Thank you.
All right. Well, this is an ongoing conversation, Senator Abler, but I do have to say that one of the things that, one of the big things that I see here is, again, how complicated all of this is. And, we put something on a spreadsheet and then the agencies have to go off and operationalize it. And I get your point. This is ours to oversee and we should do a good job of that. But I also don't want to minimize, when they say that this is a really complicated deal. I tend to believe that. But anyway, let's go to Representative Pinto and then Representative Gomez. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yeah, I had that in mind as well, that one challenge is, of course, that then in the future, we end up coming back and saying, hey, you spent $300 million and we think you didn't do a good job of it, maybe because we didn't allocate enough money to make sure that there's oversight along the way. So, but that'll be an ongoing conversation, I know. The piece relating to that I want to ask, though, is just to, confirm that when we're talking about the stabilization dollars, it's $325 million. And it seems like the feds are pretty strict that 90% of that, at least, has to go to these monthly provider grants. So that would be, you know, $325 million minus, I guess, 32.5. So that 291 or whatever the number is. But in any case, so I just want to make sure that when we're talking about grants for rehabilitation and other things, I know we'll get into the rules on that, but that would all be for the 32.5 million. The 90% of the 325 million, it seems like, Mr. Ruman, it's pretty well spelled out that it has to be monthly grants to providers that just go out once a month. There's different things we can do with that, but it really wouldn't be for the kind of physical infrastructure. Is that right?
Madam Chair, Representative Pinto, that's correct. We have very limited flexibility on that particular pot of funds. They're very clear that the funds have to go directly to providers.
Okay, thanks. And then, Madam Chair, And then I guess just one other comment, too, is that, I think I'm really glad we've had this discussion about the physical infrastructure, because I agree with what Senator Abler said. It really does what you said, too, that the House really puts a premium on that in multiple places. The Senate does. I'm glad to hear the administration is, too. I do want to note, though, that when we think about infrastructure in this sector and others as well, I mean, I think it's like 85% of the cost of running an early learning and care facility is really, it's people costs, it's personnel. And so we just want to make sure that infrastructure, we recognize it's the human infrastructure. And when you got people earning these deep poverty wages, many of whom are suffering from food insecurity themselves, we need to balance it out. But certainly the physical infrastructure is part of that. So anyway, thank you. This is really helpful to understand. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Representative Pinto. Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So for the substance use disorder and mental health block grants, it looks like DHS submitted plans for some of that money on April 3rd or whatever, 4-3. I think there was that last column where it had kind of, you know, little parts broken out. And I could just not know this because I don't serve on the proper committees, but and so maybe there was some consultation with the legislature and others know more about those plans, but I just wonder if those are like available somewhere or if they can be shared with us, kind of some of the specifics of the plan that DHS submitted to the feds under those block grants.
Representative Gomez, never assume that we know something that you don't, because there's so much to know. Thank you for the question, Mr. Greenman.
Madam Chair, Representative Gomez, I don't know any reason why they wouldn't be available. I think, especially the ones we've already submitted, I can check and see and I can get those plans either to you or to the members of on the call, whatever people would prefer. I can maybe just get them to you and to the committee staff and see if they want to distribute them.
Yeah. Mr. Greenman, I think all the information that you've been asked for, if you could get it to our staff and they can distribute it to everybody so we all, you know, get all the same information. I think that's really helpful. And, you know, even dollars that we're not distributing, and of course, it's very helpful for us to know what things have been funded or will be funded as we make our decisions. So anything else on that, Representative Gomez?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just again, sort of out of curiosity, so are those plans developed with any consultation from the legislature, or is it sort of like the agency comes up with a plan to spend those block grants and just submits it outside of our processes?
Mr. Greenman?
I believe the plan is, I know the plan's developed with stakeholders. I know we work closely with stakeholders on developing the plan and share it with them. I don't know to what extent the legislature is consulted. on the plan. That's a question.
Representative Gomez?
That's good. Just kind of looking forward to learning a little bit more about some of those big pots of money that are sort of like they're allocated for something, so we don't consider them part of this broader pot of money that we sort of collectively have to work on figuring out how to properly allocate. But it seems like it's interesting just to learn, the extent to which there is kind of specificity within some of those pots that is, I'm personally not tracking. So I appreciate the chance to ask those questions. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gomez. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question for either for Mr. Greenman or Ms. Bailey. In terms of the $560 million or the $580 million for HCBS, so that is, we're getting that from the 10% enhanced FMAP rate, the savings, which is accumulating over a year of that 10% increase. And we haven't through March of 2024 to spend that savings from that enhanced FMAP rate. Would we be able to have the luxury of coming back next year and spending some of that balance that we may not be able to agree to spend what we agreed to this session, this June 14th special session? So will we have time to maybe learn from other states or time for more guidance from the federal government? So what is really the timeline, or do we need to provide legislation to spend all of that savings?
Great question, because there may be needs that we don't know about now too. That's a great question. Mr. Greenman, can you?
Madam Chair, and I can, and Representative Schultz, I can try to answer it. And then if Ms. Bailey has anything to add, she can certainly do that. We do need to provide a plan by June 13th for how we're gonna spend the money. I believe the federal government has indicated in phone calls and in other guidelines they provided that there is some flexibility in terms of what we submit and our ability to change that later. I would say that definitely we could certainly come back. You could certainly come back next year and decide you want to spend the money on something different, or pick something new that would, fully exhaust the funds if you haven't exhausted them already. So yes, I would say you can come back next year and do it, do a supplement to what you decide to do this year.
Representative Schultz. Okay. All right. And so I think we can kind of wrap up here in a moment. I just want to note that while we've talked about, I think Senator Abler called it like we're the wash of money, but I just want to note that there's a lot on our spreadsheets that are not covered by this money. And a lot of them are things that are pretty important to members and to people in our state. And we haven't really focused on what is not covered by this money. The presentation today is on what we can spend it on, a little bit about what we could not spend it on, what our obligations are in terms of, some of the savings items have to come off our spreadsheet if we're going to make our, use this money, which, I can't imagine that members don't want to take advantage of these funds. So we're going to be under certain restrictions. But just to note for the public and of course for the work group, that there are a lot of items here that will have to be, if we're going to fund them, that we'll need to use general funds for that too. So I think that's just a really important thing to note. With that, if there are no more questions, I think we can probably wrap up this meeting. Anybody else that has a question or a comment they want to make before we end here? Because it's going on an hour and a half. Okay, and I just really want to thank House Information, because I understand that folks were given time off and then we pulled them back out of their time off to come and do this meeting for us and make it available to the public. And I just want to note that we really appreciate your doing that. I think it's been really good information. Thank you very much to the DHS staff for pulling this together for us. And we know that you're not on vacation and are really working hard to help us get through this. So appreciate everyone's ongoing hard work here, and I'll be seeing all of you soon. And with that, we are adjourned.